This Bill Simmons report is presented by the Capital One Cup, awarding the best in men's and women's college sports. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Yeah. Welcome to BS Report. 2012 ESPYs host, Rob Riggle.
Thanks.
In the studio. It's a Friday afternoon. It's
I feel
beautiful.
Bad. I just stepped on your intro, though. I feel bad.
People do that all the time. I'm not a real host. Anybody can step on my intros. It's a beautiful day outside. It's like 70 degrees. So naturally, we both want to be indoors.
That's right. In this awesome man cave you've created, by the way.
You like this.
I really do. I told you when I came in, I was like, this is what I envisioned for my secret room.
Secret room that you don't have yet.
Right. I mean, it'll
You're going to have it eventually.
Eventually.
Where do you live? What city are you in?
Los Angeles.
Oh.
Yeah. I was in New York for 10 years, but I just moved out here a couple years ago.
All right. We have so much to cover here. Yeah. I guess the first thing is...
Let's dive in.
Respecto Montalban. So how much marijuana was involved with that naming?
Was there marijuana around? I'm sure there was.
There might have been.
I don't have any documentation of such things. I was in the Marines the whole time, so I never could do anything like that.
Right.
But, you know...
How does that come up?
So it's a tough world out there.
Is it initially you want to honor Ricardo Montalban, or is it you're just throwing out weird combinations of names? I'm always fascinated by these
things. We were throwing out weird combinations of names, and we had names that we thought were cool, and names we thought were funny, and names that we thought were just abstract. And Owen Burke, who is a great producer here in Hollywood, he works over at Gary Sanchez with Will Ferrell and Adam McKay. We were all sitting around, I think it was at McManus Bar on 7th Avenue and 19th Street there in New York. And he just said, Ricardo Montalban. And we were like, yeah. And he goes, Respecto Montalban. And we were like, done. It was like, because the other one on the table, I think at the time, was like 21 or, you know, like something.
Oh, it sounded like a club.
Yeah, but it was like super douchey. And
yeah.
But that's how most of those names come out. I was on a team called... Remedial Zen at one point. Oh. Then I was on Cowbot. You get on different teams that have different names, so you never know.
For anybody who's super confused right now, these are improv groups.
Yes, sorry, yes. Names. At the UCB Theater, there are improv teams.
Improv teams.
And each team is made up of about 8 players, and you have to come up with a name for your team.
It's like a basketball team.
A little bit, a little bit.
You have your rotation, you have your 2 stars that need to share the ball, like LeBron and Wade. You have your role players, you have your young up-and-comers, old crafty vets.
Yeah.
It's like that. But you never want...
You always have your eye towards the recruits, always looking for that young talent.
Young blood always helps. Yeah. Gives you a little surge of...
And it is blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah.
No different. A lot of
blood. Well, I always felt like at the SNL cast, I've said this before on the podcast, but you probably haven't heard. Anytime in basketball, if you're playing 12 guys, it's dangerous. Nobody's getting enough minutes. They're not happy. Right. SNL works the same way.
Oh, my God.
If there's 12 people trying to get on the show, it's disaster, and then nobody ends up getting reps.
Well, that was my story. The year I was on the show, I was the only guy hired. I was the
only new guy.
I was the only new guy hired.
Yeah.
One out of a cast of 14.
Right.
14.
That's too many.
Only new guy.
And it was kind of a bridge year,
and I asked Will Ferrell
right?
about it. I was like, you know, he came and hosted, and I was like, hey, you got any advice for a new guy? And he kind of looked at me and was like, you might be a little screwed.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's not what I want to hear. What? And he's like, well, he goes, when I came on the show, there was like 5 or 6 of us in my freshman class. He's like, they had to use us. We were half the cast, and there was only 12 members back then.
Yeah.
So we were instantly half the cast. We had to be used every week, you know. He goes, you won out of 14, and you're the new guy, you know. Good luck. Because, you know, Tina's getting her time. Amy Poehler's getting her time. Horatio's getting his. Daryl Hammond's getting his. You know, like, everybody's going to get some time, and... If you're the new guy, you're shucking and jiving to make something happen. So, there's some truth to that.
So he came in there, and there was a turnover year, which is as you just said, those are the best years to come because there's a lot of shots available.
Yeah, Absolutely.
On the court.
Absolutely.
But yeah, you were like right in the middle of two different eras, which is bad.
Yep. Well, it wasn't. I think I got the best deal possible.
Why?
I got to be on SNL, which was a dream of mine my whole life.
Yeah.
I got the experience. The year that I was on, I wrote sketches that made it to air. I got a character on air, an original character. I got to do 5 impersonations. I was on every show. Except for one. I wasn't on the Paul Giamatti show. I was cut after Dress. So there was only one out of 22 shows that I missed. So by anybody's standard, I had a really good year.
Elias said you had the best show per whatever. I was coming up with some weird sabermetric stat.
But I had, by anybody's measure, I had a good year, you know. I got out. So I got the credit, and I got out before I got damaged.
Interesting. So, because usually people are on like 2-3 years, and then they kind of graduate up and they become move to the top.
A little bit. It can happen either way. I've seen guys been on that show for 7 years. You never hear from them again.
Yeah.
Ever.
Now, the one show that you didn't get on, I'm always fascinated by this. Then you have to go to the closing credits when the host comes out. It's like, all right, I've had a great time this year. I'd like to thank the musical band and blah, blah, blah. And then all the cast members are behind them. Yeah. And if you haven't been on the show, that's got to be humiliating.
Now, say that again.
So they say goodbye, the closing credits.
You're talking about SNL now? Because you said there was one show I hadn't been on?
You said you weren't on one of the 22 episodes.
Oh, right. I still get to come out after the show. And you're right. That is a bad moment.
And you're kind of like,
you're
shaking hands. Why are you shaking hands?
You're shaking hands because you were there all week and you did sketches that were in dress rehearsal that were cut after dress rehearsal.
All right.
So you spent the week hanging out with these people, meeting them, working with them. Just because it got cut after dress, hey, what are you going
to
do?
I always think the handshakes, the closing credit handshake thing sequence to me is the most fascinating part of the show.
Yeah.
I like watching it. I like seeing how everybody reacts to the host. You can always tell if they're a total dick or if everybody loved them or, you know, and how far they stand away from the person.
Sure.
And stuff like that. And sometimes they just cut like away immediately.
It is like a high school too. You know, when you're a freshman, you're a freshman and you kind of lay back a little bit. When you're more senior, you're out there in the front more. And but if the guest host and you had a scene together and you worked a lot and you hung out and you spoke, because there's a lot of downtime while you're working scenes and they're blocking scenes and you bond with people and you talk to them. And there's a lot of people that hosted that I shook hands with and became friends with. And it was good.
You tried out with your partner.
No, we tried out separately. You can't try out as a
group. You tried out at the same time.
We tried out at the same
time.
For
that season, and you made it, and he didn't. Was that, how awkward was that?
No, it wasn't awkward at all. He was very happy for me. I would have been happy for
him. Come on, it had to be a little awkward.
Well, if it was, we never talked about it.
Yeah.
You know, because we always knew what we both wanted. We both wanted to be on that show.
Yeah.
You know, and we both had legitimate shots at it, and we both gave it our best. So, and it had, honestly, he's a friend.
Yeah.
We're talking about Rob Hubel.
Yeah.
And he's a friend. And had he made it, I wouldn't have, I would have wanted to make it too. I'm not going to say that. Of course. I mean, you have ambitions in life. But had he made it and I didn't, I would be happy for him because he's a friend, you know? So.
What did you do for don't you have to do like one impersonation and one?
Yeah. If you're a stand up, you do your best 5 to 7 minutes of stand up. If you're an improviser, like I was, you don't have a stand up routine. So you do 3 original characters and 3 impersonations.
Wow.
Or any variation thereof, 4-2, 2-4, not 5-1, but usually like 6 characters.
You do 6?
Generally speaking, yes.
So do you put your best one first or do you save it last? Like what's the order? A lot of strategy. Like baseball?
A lot of strategy involved in that, you know?
So if your cleanup hitter bats fourth?
I always just went with what was the funniest. You know, I did my, you know, like if I did an impersonation, which I don't do impersonations, I just don't. Yeah. I would put some of those in the front, and then the characters that I created, I thought had funnier monologues, and I would do those last. And again, you don't have much time. You have 5 to 7 minutes to do 6 characters, so you're popping in and out of character. You know, you're like up there whipping through stuff.
And how many people are trying out? Can you see all of them? Is it almost like trying out for a role?
It depends on the year, but on average, they probably go out and get about 20 people that audition. And it depends on what they're looking for. They might be looking for a woman that year. They might be looking for a man. They might be a woman man or a lady boy.
Yeah.
You never know what they're looking for. So it just depends on what they're looking for. And you know, they bring them in from Toronto, from Chicago, from New York, from Las Vegas, from LA, and they fly you all in. And when you get there, it sounds like you want to know about the audition process.
No, I was just curious about like.
Well, they bring 20 people in.
You said you were, you know, this is one of your big goals. So here's this big day.
Yeah.
And then you have all these people you're sizing up. Obviously, you have to beat some of
these competition.
People. Yeah.
It's total competition. They had one slot that they were looking to hire for. Yeah. There's 20 of us from around the country.
And you probably knew some of them, right?
There's SNL writers who are on there trying to audition. I mean, the year I got on, Sudeikis auditioned. And so did, like, Rich Tellerico and some of these other writers that were on the show writing.
Yeah.
That you talk about it, you know, knowing what they like and what they don't like and what works, you know, they, you know, that it's tough competition, you know, you gotta have your head on.
And they have a little feel for Lauren and the thinking, I would guess.
Well, they had, you know, when you go out there and do it, it's a 2-day process too.
Yeah.
You know, the first day you go to a stand-up club and you do the best you can.
Yeah.
And they have all 20 people. Then that night you get a call saying whether or not you made it to the next level. Then the next day you go to 30 Rock and you actually go up to the studio 8H where you actually go out on the stage where the host comes out at the beginning of the show and you do it all over. But that time they've gone from 20 down to 7 or 5. So it's, if you make it to the next day, okay, you're on to phase 2. Then you come out and you do your best. They put you on camera so the people in Burbank can watch. Lauren, Tina, all the, you know, head writers and producers, Shoemaker and Higgins sit out there. And they saw you the night before, so they're not going to laugh because they know your material.
Right.
And then you come out and you do it again. And this time they even tell you to cut it down a little bit. So you got to make decisions on what you're cutting, what you're keeping. Then you go out and do it again. And then you wait a couple weeks. And then you find out if you got on or not.
What happened? How did you get on The Daily Show? How was that
same
process
thing.
Different?
I auditioned. I was out here in L.A. and I went in and auditioned and got a call back to New York to go in studio and audition with John.
Hmm.
And it was down to me and another guy, and I got it. So that was good.
That story wasn't as rich as the first one.
Well, I don't want to, I could bore you. It is rich, actually. I could go into it, but
well,
you
probably SNL thing must have bought you a little credibility or a little something.
It
little
did, but it was,
luster.
You know, after I left that show, it was about a year before I got, you know, I had a year where I was developing a pilot for NBC.
Yeah.
And then it was, so I left in 2005 and I got on 2006. So about a year before I got on The Daily Show.
So how many?
And they're only hiring 2 people for The Daily Show, and they were doing a global search. They hired John Oliver in England, in London, and they hired me. It was a process. I mean, it was Roy Albanese, who's the executive producer, we should ask him, but I think they had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of auditions for that.
And that is one of the most beloved shows on the internet, the way it's digested and devoured and picked apart. And
People really gravitate towards it. They consider it a news source, which is terrifying.
Right. So did you, once you started going on, were you conscious of the feedback? Did you care? Did you ignore that stuff?
No, I learned after SNL never to read anything.
Oh, really?
I don't care. I honestly, I don't read a word.
But at SNL you did? Did you
I
read
did.
Something damaging?
Sure. Oh, of course. The SNL geeks, they live in their basement and they're angry and there have been fans for 30 years and they think they know everything about the show and they actually have some scary intel on the show. Like they know, it's bizarre. But, you know, that you get on there and then, but, you know, and they say terrible things about you. Oh, you're fat. Oh, you're this. Oh, you're that. Oh, you're not funny. Oh, you know, just anything they can pick you apart on, they pick you apart. And they're so safe behind their keyboards, you know? It's just pathetic. But Will Ferrell, same thing, you know? I mean, they went after him for the first couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, it takes time on that show to get your legs, to find your voice, to resonate with the audience. So unless you have that time, it's never going to happen.
Bill Hader was on this podcast a few months ago, and he told the
great
story
guy,
about...
Great guy, by the way. Great guy.
He told this story about somebody who had ripped him to shreds in some internet thing, and then he had a driver... A few months later or something, it turned out he pieced it together, and the guy who was driving him
was the
guy who wrote the thing.
Yeah.
And
it's amazing. You say hi to somebody at a coffee shop, and they'll go tweet or write about it.
Yeah.
And so unless you're sticky sweet, they're like, "Whoa, this guy's a douche."
Yeah, what a jerk.
Yeah, what a jerk. No, I'm just buying my coffee.
Yeah.
You know, sorry I didn't massage your feet.
Well, you were kind of there in The Daily Show. That was. It kind of went up a level because of that 08 election and just seemed like it was already really popular, but it seemed like it really blew up.
Yeah, I mean,
during
the show definitely got a lot of traction. It definitely got a lot of traction. not because of me, but right. during the time frame I was there.
You were there.
Yeah, I was there when it was when it seemed to really be that 2006 to 2009 time frame seemed to.
Because you made me think of there was a feature written about Jon Stewart probably 9 months ago. I think it was Esquire or GQ or something. They kind of nobody had written a Jon Stewart takedown.
Oh, really?
Because Jon Stewart is like 100% approval rating. Everyone's just, oh, that guy's smart. That guy's funny. Like nobody.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are people out there who don't.
Well, there's those people. But somebody tried to do the takedown feature, and it was really interesting. It was almost like, wow.
Well, but that's America.
Yeah.
That's America. If you know, people want to celebrate and lift you up and build your success. And then if you get to a place that they're not comfortable with, they're going to take you down a peg. That's just the way that's the way America rolls.
We're going to have to bleep this, but I call it who the f*** is this guy? You don't never want to get to that point. People are like, who the f*** is this guy?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of that.
And then that kind of turns out.
Yeah. So I never read anything now. After I read that one time on SNL, I made the mistake of checking a blog or something I looked at. And it hurt. And I was like, that sucks. I didn't do anything wrong. Like, what are they? F these people. Yeah. So then I was like, all right, here's what, I'm just not going to do it anymore. So I've never read anything and I won't because it's ignorance is bliss and I'm a blissful guy.
But like you're in 21 Jump Street and you got really good reviews.
Never know. I don't care.
You don't have that one person be like, come on, tell me, did I get good reviews? No.
I don't want to know. I swear I don't want to know because I'm sure if there were nice ones, that's great. And I'm happy, but I'm sure there were bad ones too. And I'm just happy going through life in my ignorant bliss.
So you always get asked about your military background.
Sure.
I'm sure you've always had a sense of humor.
Yeah. Absolutely.
There's a lot of dead time in the military. I'm sure that was a good thing for...
For entertaining my peers.
Yeah, absolutely.
I never was a jackass in front of my Marines, though.
Right.
Because, I was an officer. Yeah. I never wanted to... There had to be a certain order and discipline.
Right.
You never wanted to present yourself as a jerk-off because they would... I never wanted them to think that I didn't value their lives or what we were doing. So I had one hat I would wear in front of the Marines, and when I was back in my tent or back in barracks around my colleagues or peers or fellow officers, then I would maybe relax a little bit.
Maybe do a couple characters.
Maybe a little bit. Maybe a little bit. Maybe some impersonations of some commanding officers that needed to be done. Take the piss out of some of these guys.
Yeah. How you're a sports fan though? How do you follow sports when you're abroad like that, or do you just you checked out?
You kind of check out a little bit, but
I bet you're not in a fantasy league when you're in Afghanistan.
No. Although I imagine now they have such connectivity now that I bet they probably can do that.
But when I was there, scary, right? I get emails from. Yeah. I'm always amazed when I get emails from there. Hey,
Afghanistan, it was very Spartan. It was 2001. I mean, it was. 2 months after 9/11, I was there in the northern part of Afghanistan, and it was Spartan. Like, we really didn't have much connectivity. We had running power from Uzbekistan that would shut off for certain hours during the day, and you never knew it was going to shut off. And so it was more Spartan. But now I think they have more infrastructure over there, so I think maybe they probably could do fantasy football over there.
So how did you end up there 2 months after 9/11? I'm sure you're already in the military.
I was in the reserves. Where were you originally? I was in the reserves on 9/11. I was in the reserves, but I was in a reserve unit in Manhattan, New York. So the night of September 11th, I was actually activated because my reserve unit was the only reserve unit in Manhattan. And when they closed the bridges and tunnels, I got a call from my commanding officer saying, "We've been activated." This is on September 11th.
Yeah.
We've been activated. Report to Ground Zero tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. So I was like, "Got it." So I worked on Ground Zero, moving rubble by hand in the bucket brigades from the 12th to the 18th of September. 12 on, 12 off, 12 on, 12 off until the 18th. And then I think they declared it wasn't a search and rescue anymore. It was search and recovery. That being the case, they could bring in the heavy machinery to start moving stuff because it was like six stories of rubble. But for the first 6 days, we thought there might be survivors, and you didn't want to bring in heavy equipment and all that stuff. So, and then I went from there to One Police Plaza, and I helped coordinate military and civilian efforts on the recovery process. So that took me through September 30th. Then my orders were up, so we were done. But I had a pretty high security clearance for my job, which was unusual for my job. So I figured they're going to need people. So I volunteered to go back on active duty, and I got orders on November 10th, which is the Marine Corps birthday. November 17th, I reported to Central Command down in Tampa, Florida, And on November 30th, I was on a plane to Afghanistan.
And you were already doing a lot of the comedy stuff.
Oh, I was deep into comedy. Yeah. I was at the UCB. I was actually teaching classes at the UCB.
Oh, my God.
And, but I was also in the reserves, and I was a captain. And so I got called back for a year, went back, did my year, got back towards the beginning of 2003. And then 2004, I got on Saturday Night Live.
How did you make the decision to go Marines? I'm always interested in this answer.
They have the highest standards.
Interesting. If you had to do it over again, would you have made the same choice?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because I've heard, anytime I ask this, it seems like the Air Force is an intriguing choice.
They, trust me, if I had kids, I'd tell them to go to the Air Force.
Yeah, because you get to be in the same place for a big chunk, right?
Well,
like
yeah.
6 to 8 months at a time.
Air Force, they're awesome. They're really awesome. And they recruit highly intelligent people.
Yeah.
And they're a pretty sharp outfit. The Air Force is all right. And they live well.
Yeah.
They live a lot better than Marines. We're expeditionary. We have to get used to living in the mud and tents and kind of Spartan existence, you know, because we never go anywhere and stay very long. We just kick in the door.
Marines seems like has the highest badass potential.
I think so.
Like if you want, it has the highest ceiling to really kick ass.
But the Air Force, they're awesome, I think, too. They do all right. There's the old joke that Air Force, they always go wherever they go build a base. They usually build the golf course first. Then they go back to Congress and they ask for money for the runways,
right?
You know, and that's generally, I think, the case. But they're awesome. I'm not taking too many digs on the Air Force.
So when we killed Bin Laden,
yeah,
did you find yourself riveted by that story and the details and how they did it and all that stuff? Or at this point, you don't care?
Oh no, I care.
I mean, like about the details, the nitty-gritty.
Oh
stuff.
Yeah, well. Yeah, there's certain things that you're always interested. I mean, you always want to know how something like that unfolded or went down, and it's always going to be intriguing. So yeah, I was definitely interested in it.
How far away could you? What's the Navy SEAL equivalent for Marines? What's the highest you could go?
You mean like Special Forces?
Yeah,
Special Operations.
Special Ops.
Special Ops. We have what's called the Marine Force Recon. Which is every branch of service has their own special high speed, you know, hoo-yah type guys.
So how far away were you from that?
Oh, I was far away from that. I'm not a jungle snake eater, you know, type guy. You know, these guys were out there. Those Force Recon guys are badass, and so are the SEALs. So are the PJs for the Air Force. So are the Army Rangers and the Army Special Op guys and their Delta Force, and you know. But we have Marines are badass in general, and we have our Force Recon bubbles.
So people don't want to heckle you during one of your improv nights. It's probably a bad idea.
Yeah, it is. Only not because of anything physical, God no. Just because my mouth will lay waste to them.
You are not going to get heckled at the ESPYs. The first six rows are basically just ESPN executives who are half asleep. That's going to be the most congenial
audience.
I'm
a little nervous. You know, I've seen these crowds in the past. They seem a little tight. They seem a little tight. They don't give up much. They just sit there and they got this look on their face of annoyance. And it's like, guys, it's a night of celebration. Let's have some fun. And they're like, ugh. You're like, well, I'm sorry if the one night a year people, you know, you're all together and we're celebrating you isn't good enough for you.
I think they're with you until the first joke doesn't work. And then after that, it moves into that mode of, all right, is this going to be a long night or not? So
well,
no pressure.
That'll be early. So, you know,
get that out of the way.
I'm going to knock that out early. I'm just going to take a big dump. First word out of my mouth is going to be in the.
Yeah.
No, it's going to be fun. We're going to have fun. It's a fun show. It's not a celebration. I'm excited about it. I'm going to have fun. So. Come on board, you know. Get on board or don't. I don't care.
What's your favorite sport?
Football.
Football.
Yeah.
Usually
and college
some football
basketball.
Players.
College basketball, too.
Because of Kansas?
Definitely.
And that's why you're friends with Sudeikis?
Absolutely. Well, and we also grew up in the same hometown, and we worked on SNL together, and there's a lot of reasons I'm friends with Sudeikis.
So?
We do a charity event together. We co-host a charity event together.
Paul Rudd, Kansas City.
Paul Rudd, Kansas City. We went to KU together.
John Hamm, St. Louis.
Yeah.
Who else is in? There's like this weird St. Louis, Kansas City, like.
Well, there's a Missouri, Kansas City connection.
Missouri,
Dave Koechner, the wonderful Dave Koechner from mid-Missouri, married a Kansas City girl. Eric Stone Street, Kansas City guy.
So that's six now.
Yeah. There's a lot of talent coming out of there.
Because everybody talks about Canada, but maybe nobody, people should talk more about the...
They should look on the old Missouri River there.
So Kansas basketball.
Kansas basketball. I'm a Jayhawk. I graduated from KU with a theater and film major.
Where'd you watch the Chalmers game?
New York. I was in New York. I was working on a field piece for The Daily Show, and we went late, and I was like, guys, you don't get it. It's the championship. I gotta go. They finally let me go, and I raced home and I watched it at my apartment. So I didn't get to watch it with a bunch of people.
Don't taunt Derrick Rose about it. If he's at the, I don't know if he's at the Espies or not. If he's at a rough year,
yeah.
Well, you don't have to bring up the game to him.
I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't
point
that.
At him. Talk about just, the KU.
Just held up a sign in 2008.
What celebrities do we have in store for this? I have not done any.
Oh, God.
I've not done the vetting. I mean, usually most of the football players come.
We got a lot.
Most of the NBA players come.
We do. We have some. We have some great athletes that are going to be there. A lot of football players, a lot of basketball players. We've got a lot of celebrities, some very beautiful celebrities going to be there. You might want to.
I could probably guess who a couple of them are.
Go for it. I'll give you a wink.
I would guess Kate Upton is going to be here.
Mm. See, I don't know what I can tell you, what I can't tell you.
All right, don't tell me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to give away too much. All I can say is tune in if you want to have some fun and see some magic.
And you've taped all your stuff.
The pre-tapes, yes.
Pre-tapes.
Well, not all of it. We've still got a couple more to do.
All right.
I know. We're getting down to the wire.
How are you feeling about those?
Oh, we're having a blast. I feel good about them.
How much has ESPN tried to censor you and ruin your life over these last few weeks?
Well, they haven't tried to ruin my life, but, you know, it's you can't just go in there and do what you want to do. That's for sure. You got to... It's a big team process, and there's considerations to be made. And but I will say,
I know
this
how that
is
dance
a,
goes.
This is, but they're a great group of guys and gals, and we have a great executive producer, Maura. Maura Mant. that's awesome. John Walsh, you're going to be talking to in a little bit.
Yeah,
we got. So they're great.
Heard of him.
They're great people that are very flexible, and they're trying to, you know, let us get away with as much as we can. But it's still a family show.
So family show.
Family show. Got to play it. Got to play
it's
it.
9 o'clock, right?
A certain way.
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock East Coast
9 o'clock
time.
Wednesday.
Yeah.
20th ESPYs.
20th ESPYs, July 11th, 9 o'clock Eastern. Don't miss out.
They didn't do Roman numerals for this though, which I was very curious about.
They should have two X's because you can do cool things with like stamping two X's and two. The T-shirts would have been cool too. I think with the
I
two
totally
X's.
Agree.
Yeah, I don't get
it's
it.
Only like the Olympics, Super Bowl, and WrestleMania have been the only ones who really captured the Roman numerals for the most part.
Especially when you got cool Roman numerals like that.
Yeah, the 20. I think they made a mistake.
Yeah, I'm no marketing genius, but I think that's pretty self-explanatory, right?
We think we'll get Steve Nash at this thing. New L.A.?
Hello,
L.A. personality?
Yeah, what about maybe even get Dwight Howard in there, too?
All right, now it's Friday. It's, what time is it? It's 10 after 1 on Friday afternoon. Yep. I think Dwight Howard is going to be a Laker. I have no inside information on this. It's always made the most sense.
I think Bynum's out.
Bynum's out.
Meta, and they bring in Dwight.
And another contract. I think they have to take another contract.
Yeah.
A Turkish guy.
You think?
He did Turkoglu. I think that he gets thrown in. He's a part of the deal.
Okay.
But yeah, I think that happens.
Yeah.
It's very logical.
I think so,
too. It's always been the most logical spot for him.
Okay, now if that happens.
I'm scared.
Do they beat Oklahoma City?
I'm very scared.
Do they win the West?
Well, now at that point, you have to hope Father Time gets involved. As Charles Barkley says.
What are you talking about? Is Nash 37, 38?
Nash turns 39 during the season.
So there you go. So yeah, now, like this would it would have to pop next year.
Kobe's going to be, I think, 34, but he's had this is he came into the league in '96, and he has all those NBA miles on his knees, which is why he keeps going to Germany to do things to make them feel better. At some point, he's going to break down.
Yeah.
Gasol, who knows emotionally how he'll handle this? He's got new teammates. Right, I don't know.
Yeah, there's somebody else is peeing on his tree now.
We don't know. Yeah. Who knows with him? Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, all the things I'm grasping onto as a Celtic fan are not real things. I'm nervous. The Dwight Howard thing. I think if Bynum stays, it's fine. Yeah. I'm not worried because I think Bynum will get clumsy and then Nash and he'll be worried about getting Kobe shots and it's just I think it'll be too complicated. But if Howard's in there, it all kind of falls into place. That's what scares me.
Which I think is what they're gunning for, and I think that's what we're gonna see.
Yeah. Houston is trying to throw the kitchen sink for the Howard trade, I know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And they're also hooking and jabbing for Lynn, but the Knicks aren't going to let Lynn.
Yeah, that was stupid. The Knicks, they don't care about money. The Knicks throw money around. They don't care.
Yeah. But they're not going to let him go. They're not going to
No.
Let him, yeah.
Of course they're not going
to
let him go.
But they're bringing in Kidd, which makes, which raises a flag to me, though. Because it makes me think, why would they carry both of those?
Because the Knicks always like to have one really washed up guy on the team. You know what I realize? Every year they have a washed up guy. They have a spot for him in salary.
That's an interesting angle.
I think they wanted him for veteran leadership. He can shoot threes. He can be their backup point guard, but play a little two guard. Okay. And I don't know. It's always – it's the thing with, that's funny about Kidd to me is, like, he wants to play 20 years.
Yeah.
That's like they always say that. And then, well, I'm sure he does. That doesn't mean it's a good idea. 20 years seems like a lot. But that'll be interesting, too. Yeah. If they get Lynn back, I actually think they're going to be dumb enough to match the Landry Fields Toronto offer of $20 million. Because, then again, they don't care about money. They just rake money in.
$20 million, what do you
for
have?
For 3 years.
And what did Lynn
have? He's like an 11th man, Landry Fields.
But Lynn, what did he have last year, 30 starts?
Yeah, it was like 26.
26 starts for $20
million. Well, here's the thing. Well, no, Lynn was more.
I love this country.
Lynn was 24. Lynn was 24. But I think the thing with Lynn is you get all the overseas money.
Oh,
you can market
bank. Him. Yeah, I mean, come on. That's what, yeah. There's always a rhyme behind the reason there, and that's what it is.
There's always a joke when Yao Ming wanted to retire. Houston was like, no, don't retire for one more year. Just wear a suit. We'll pay you $15 million. Because they would have like tripled it going back because with all the Far East money.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It'll be interesting. It seems like the merry-go-round is going to stop soon, though, because most of the guys have signed.
Yeah, things have got to shake out here soon. Yeah. So, but it's been entertaining. You can't deny that.
My worst fear for the ESPYs is Dwight Howard, Kobe, Nash and Gasol all standing on stage with you, all with their hands up like this.
I like it.
I might charge the stage with like a pickaxe or something. All right. Good luck.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. I love your man cave.
Thank you. If you ever want any recommendations on wood paneling.
No, yeah, well, I would, yes. I will, tell I will come to you and get it because that is quality wood paneling. And you sit in here and watch games on the weekends and stuff?
No. That would be kind of weird because I have a family and a house. We're going to watch something.
And I'm sure that family
TV, so.
Interrupts your game watching. What are we talking about?
Nah, they're locked out. They have certain times they can't come in. Wednesday night, 9 o'clock. John Walsh is going to come on now for a little bit.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, yeah. July 11th. Check out the ESPYs. It's going to be a lot of fun.
And 21 Jump Street on demand, which was excellent.
Thank you.
I really liked it.
Good.
I told you that was where we're walking in. I wasn't like a smoke blow.
Yeah, yeah. No, I appreciate it.
No, it was good. I've rented so many bad movies.
Right.
Because, you know, once you have like two kids, you're basically trapped to on demand after 9 o'clock on a Friday night, unless you have a babysitter. And it was so nice to rent a movie and just kind of laugh and not be mad about it the entire time.
Good.
Which so often happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm falling in the same trap as well.
A couple unexpected twists and surprises, too. I don't want to spoil, but there was one. I was like, whoa, how did that happen?
Yeah.
I won't say, but if anyone has seen the movie, they know.
Yeah.
There was one.
It really slips past you until it actually unfolds.
Yeah. I was like, oh, my God, what's happening?
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Yeah. Anyway, I won't spoil, but good luck on Wednesday.
All right, man. Thanks,
Thank
Bill.
You. All right, bringing in the executive editor of ESPN, my boss, John A. Walsh, the 20th ESPYs. You've been here for all 20.
Actually, 19, but that's okay.
What do you mean?
There was one year where we tried the trial show, should Pete Rose be in the Hall of Fame, taped at Harvard, and it was conflicting with the ESPYs, so I didn't do the ESPYs that year.
Oh, but there has been 20 ESPYs.
There have been 20 ESPYs.
Took some heat over the years. Now it's kind of is what it is.
Yeah, it went through an evolution.
I remember making fun of it in a couple columns on an old website.
That's why we hired you, because you knew how to make fun of it. But it's taken on a form, and it, you know, from Dennis Miller, who was irreverent and funny, and had, you know, I still think the first show was one of the 5 or 6, 7 best of the 20, because of DeBears and Jim Valvano, and Dennis had a great night, and he dressed in the woman Dottie Mockery's dress for a presentation. There were a lot of great things about that first show. But what we did, we learned over the years, we tried to kind of have it both ways and make jokes and make fun, and sometimes they became cruel, and it wasn't really right. And once we determined, it must have been 7, 8, 9 years ago, that it's a celebration of sports, we pretty much stick to that script. And when Rob was talking about, well, what happens when new people come on, whether they're writers or hosts, we just say, you know, certain things are out. We're not making fun of the sport of soccer. You know, the writers every year would come in and make a fun because soccer really isn't a sport. Well, they've been proven wrong, but we every year, it's amazing to me. I just say one thing, guys, we can't make fun of sports because there's athletes from those sports who are in the audience and they come here to celebrate. That's one of the lessons that we learned.
Well, also, it's not even an accurate humor joke anymore.
Well, that's what I mean.
Soccer's gained steam.
The boys have been proven wrong.
Yeah. There might be other sports to make fun of, but I don't know if I'd go after soccer. Although I will say, though, the Euros, for the potential that it had, the last few games weren't good. You know, just it is what it is. But it was poised to be a much bigger event than I think it ended up being.
Well, I think that the countries that made it into the finals really helped the U.S. audience in terms of immigration.
Totally.
That was a big plus for television. But the games themselves weren't what we'd hoped they would be.
Yeah. Well, that's luck of the draw sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about live events and just what the ESPN has swallowed up so many live events to things. And I think it's really interesting that the ratings for live events have either kind of stayed straight or gone up over the last couple of years. Whereas, like, if you look at traditional TV and dramas and comedies and things like that, all that stuff's trending downwards because it's so splintered now with internet and with on demand and there's so many channels now. And yet live events seem like they're almost immune to this. Do you feel like the live events are actually in a better place than they've ever been?
Oh, absolutely. Because I think of the internet and talk radio and spoiler alerts. Things have been given away. You can do a lot of things on demand. If you really want to see and experience the drama of a sporting event, you've got to watch it live.
Totally. I totally agree. And you can try to tape it and pretend you're not going to find out the score, but it's pretty hard, and it's near impossible, actually.
Well, it's impossible now. I even in the old days, I mean, going back 20, 30 years while watching TV or being in TV, I was shocked that people would even think that taping a tape-delayed event was worth something.
Yeah.
I remember in the original days of ESPN when college football was taped on Saturday afternoon and they could start showing it at midnight on Saturday night, and that was from 1979 to 1985.
Yeah.
It was only in 1986 when ESPN finally was allowed to do live games. And I would never watch those college football. Even though I'm a big college football fan, I never wanted to watch a tape-delayed game on Saturday night at midnight or Sunday at 10 a.m.
I'm old enough to remember the greatest sporting event of all time, the USA 4, USSR 3, 1980 Olympics. That was tape delayed.
Yes, it was. And I remember being at the Cowboy Bar in New York with Pete Axthelm, whose friend was writing it, and running to the phone and calling up and getting the score as before the tape delay went on.
Right. We were in the supermarket and heard the score after two periods, and it was either, I think it was tied after two periods, I don't remember, but just knowing that we were in the game and then going home and just kind of waiting for the tape delay game to start. But those days are long gone. And the reason I brought that up was the ESPYs are now live, which is something that in this day and age kind of feels like it had to happen.
Well, the ESPYs were live.
I know.
ESPYs
and then it began
live
tape
for, the first year was live, an hour tape delay, because we were afraid of what would happen because we'd never
probably
done a show.
Probably should have been, yeah.
But yes, and it proved to be correct. And then the next, it must have been probably 10, 12 years. I think we were live to tape, taped on Wednesday, live on Sunday, maybe 4 years, 5 years.
Right.
So about 75% of them have been live.
Not last year was the first one that had been live in a while, or 2 years ago?
Two years ago.
Yeah. So the ESPYs, when you look at it, it brings a lot of things to the table that could potentially be bad for ESPN. One, the ability to make fun of ourselves, which we've struggled with over the years.
But still, one of the, and I will defend the show in this respect, is when we really had to make fun, the decision, it was one of the most brilliant pieces that the ESPYs have ever done with Steve Carell and Paul Rudd. That was just great.
So in a way, it's probably good because there's no way you can do the ESPYs without making fun of ESPN a little bit, which I feel like we've been able to do.
Yeah,
I'm going to use we since I work for the company.
And you can make fun of ESPN.
Yeah, and I like making fun of ESPN, but it always comes from a good place. And then you also have a bunch of athletes that are there.
Well,
that we are the host of all these different parties, like that could potentially go in a bunch of bad directions. And I don't ever remember that really coming back to haunt ESPN
well, not
has
only has it?
It
not haunted us, but in those first years, I remember, you know, the first ESPY, I think the one athlete that was going to present, Randall Cunningham, or was it Mike Singletary, one of the two, was caught in a plane over Albany in an ice storm and didn't show up. Hmm. So Chris Berman had to play the part of Mike Singletary. But we maybe there were three or four athletes that weren't in the show the first year. And I believe in these last couple of years, we're somewhere between 140 and 200 athletes come to Los Angeles to the show. Hmm. So it's a real show of the athletic community, and we try and give them a nice experience so they feel, you know, good about what the show is and what the roles they can play in it.
What's your single favorite ESPY story?
I guess the first year, the first show, I had never done an award show. I had written proposals for award shows. In fact, a show similar to the ESPYs, which I'd given to ESPN when I was hired in 1987. But the first year we were doing a show, and my boss was Jim Allegro, a beautiful man, a wonderful guy, and he hadn't done it. Oh, we have to sell tickets? Oh, really? Oh, that's part of what you do in the show. You have to get tickets. You have to print them. You have to sell them. You have to have invitations. You have to do a lot of these things. And we had a wonderful producer, Ed Griles, who had done Universe Pageant, Miss Universe Pageant shows. So he knew the award show march. And so we were working real hard on the show, and the president of the company, our boss, Steve Bornstein, comes over to Jim Allegro and me in the afternoon at the Paramount Theater at the Garden, and we say, yeah, you know, we think we got the show under 3 hours. And Steve looks at us and says, and this is at 3 p.m, he says, if you don't get this show down to 2 hours, you guys could be fired by tomorrow. Jim and I are looking at each other. So we go, we're cutting down the show, Robert Smigel and we're collapsing things, and Robert Smigel and DeBears are on the set, and they had a great bit about the ESPY pool.
Yeah.
And every winner that they projected was Ditka, except for a female athlete, they chose Mrs. Ditka. And it's a really great jokes, but they weren't getting on the show. So Smigel walks up at one point, and a beautiful man, Robert, and he says, John, why should I be here? We're going to go home. So I said, Ed, you got to get these guys in the show.
Right.
So we get them in the show, so it's a little bit longer. And then it comes time for the V Award, and it's Jim Valvano's the most emotional moment in the history of the show.
That was the first one?
First one.
Oh, I didn't know that, I knew that and forgot it.
Anyway, it was... That was the moment, and we had him down for a 3-minute speech, and he walked up there, and one of the producers, I forget who it was, started to flash the red light, and Jim, in legendary fashion, points to the red light. He says, "I'm about ready to die. Do you think I care about that red light?"
Yeah.
And so the show then went. The show, his speech went 17 minutes, and we had it scheduled for 3. So then the rest of the night was sure horror about going back and forth and cutting sections and putting two presentations together and changing presenter combinations. We didn't know what the hell we were doing.
Yeah.
But we got it done, and then the show was over. And one of the executives from the company comes up and he says, John, you have an hour to cut the show down for a re-air at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so it was so bad that I was shaking. I was coming back and I figured, well, boy, I can have a beer. It was so late. I went up. The bar was closed for the after party. But it was an interesting night, and I'll never forget that night.
And that's why the after parties now last until 8 a.m. the next morning because of that one experience here.
Well, I'm old enough not to be able to make it past midnight.
So, do you think that Jimmy V moment, the fact that happened in the first show, that must have just helped it because that became the iconic moment?
Well, we didn't really know, you know, if this was going to work. And we came back up, and Steve Bornstein, despite the fact that the show did go, I think, 2 hours and 38 minutes, we came back up, and Steve came over to me and shook his hand, and he said, thank you. We have an annual award show.
Ah.
He knew right away, especially because of the and give credit to John Lack, who was an executive at ESPN at the time. John was the person who said that we should give an Arthur Ashe Award and we should give the first one to Jimmy V. And that was added into the show.
For the listeners, Bornstein was the guy running ESPN at the time.
No, he was actually running.
What was his job?
I think he was the head of programming and production.
Yeah, at the time. He was. Bodenheimer was running everything, but he was the guy who made the decisions
He probably was president.
Oh yeah, you're right.
He was president by then. Yes,
I got to read the ESPN book again. Yeah. Oh wait, I burned it.
I got to remember it.
I burned the ESPN book.
Steve was the president.
I was such a jerk at it. Yeah, so that was, who do you think was the best host then?
I think the best show in terms of everything clicking because of a musical number and everything else was the year that Justin Timberlake did it. But it's really hard. There are 7 or 8 or 9 shows that, you know, terrific hosts that did. Like I said, Dennis Miller's first year. Seth was fantastic last 2 years. Samuel L. did 3 years. Jamie Foxx. Man, that, you know, the Serena tennis ball bit is one of the most memorable moments in the show. We've had, I think, a fair share of terrific shows, especially lately now that I think we've reached a cruising altitude. And Maura, whom Rob mentioned, is running the show and has an idea of the ins and outs and what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Is it true you're retiring after the Super Bowl?
No, I'm staying on. Mr. Skipper and I have agreed that I'm going to go into 2014.
I knew you weren't going to retire. You're so full of crap.
Got to make sure Grantland's a huge success.
You're like the Brett Favre of sports media. I'm leaving. No, this is it. Now this is gonna be my last year. Now 2014. So we made news here.
Yeah, you made news.
Your buddy Richard Deitch might tweet this later.
Is he one of your loyal listeners?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, you'll find out now.
Because somebody will tweet him now, and then he'll tweet, and then things will get misinterpreted, and something bad will happen. So 2014.
Yes.
Is part of this new contract that you're moving into my guest room? Be honest.
Well, I'd like to spend more time in the warm weather. I make no bones. When it can snow.
All right, but
life is changing. Life is changing. We're going to have a grandchild next month, and so the world is going to be different.
This sounds promising.
That's very promising.
So 2014.
Yes.
And how long will your career be at that point then? Will that be?
I'll be 69 years old and I will have worked for 46 years.
In 2014 will be, it'll be 27 years at ESPN?
Yes. 26.
26 years at ESPN.
26 years, yes.
And yeah. How different do you think SportsCenter is going to be over this rest of this decade? Because you're credited as the person who moved SportsCenter into the direction it is now, made it more newsy, all that stuff. And now you have ESPN.com, which is basically a 24-hour SportsCenter video.
I think that's one of the big challenges, Bill, is that SportsCenter had an embryonic stage or a birthing stage, an embryonic stage where people were trying to find out, my God, you know, the largest sportscast on a nightly basis. Prior to that were local newscasts of 3 minutes and maybe a Sunday night telecast once a week of 30 minutes. And these people were putting on shows that sometimes were as small as 15 minutes and sometimes as long as an hour and a half or 2 hours. And then it finally settled on 3 half-hour shows a day. So I think that stage went on. And then when we got there, Steve Anderson and I, we made some changes in staffing. We made some changes in the direction of the show. We learned about the behaviors of our audience, and we made some changes in the rundown of the show and some of the people on camera. And we went through and we got some reporting. We got a lot of reporters over the period of time, which heretofore didn't really exist. I think they had one freelance reporter, part-time reporter before we started hiring the Andrea Kramers and the Jimmy Robertses and Chris Myers and Mark Schwartzes of the world. So there was some big changes. Then there's a period in the early 2000s when Mark Shapiro brought on shows like PTI to the network and changed some of the elements of SportsCenter to reflect opinion. And now we're in a period where the technology and social media and Twitter are changing the dynamics of the consumption of sports media. So SportsCenter will enter yet what I would call its fourth or fifth period, and we don't know what that's going to be.
SportsCenter 5.0.
That's probably what it is.
Yeah, I don't know where it goes because you know what really changed? Like about a year ago or maybe like 18 months ago, all of a sudden you could watch highlights of any game on ESPN.com pretty quickly after the game ended. Like if I missed the Red Sox game, I could go into the Red Sox box score recap thing and the video was there and it was just ready to click it and I could see the highlights. I thought that was a game changer for me personally because a lot of times I was watching SportsCenter partially because I got to get the Red Sox highlights. Now I don't need SportsCenter for that. And it makes me wonder, as live streaming just gets better and better, the iPad, certainly none of us anticipated the whole iPad and the way that was going to change the way people consume things. I do wonder, will SportsCenter have to evolve into more like a First Take type show?
Well, I think there are a lot of elements. The biggest thing that I believe is true, whether it's 140 characters or it's a 12-minute piece on SportsCenter or Outside the Lines or wherever, that storytelling is more important than anything else and than it ever has been. And storytelling, whether it's a highlight and an originality, taking the time to do the highlight in a different order and way from the traditional ways we've done it, being able to do readers about the strange things that are happening in sports, taking some of the stories and evolving them with the different angles. You also have certain paradigms in the business have changed. The beat reporter is still important. The notes reporter is still important. But now there are beats that are emerging about technology, about analytics, about international sports. Women's sports is gaining momentum. There are a lot of things that are going to happen where and highlights are endemic to all of the elements of what we do. But storytelling is going to be, if you're talking to, like talk to college students, tell them the one thing that you want to learn, whether it's reading novels, whether it's reading biographies or whatever, is how to tell a good story. Because that's going to win the day no matter what.
So you don't see SportsCenter changing into more of a debate show with some highlights where you push stuff on ESPN.com and you integrate the website more? I don't know.
Don't you think that with talk radio and with somewhat with some podcasts and with the number of shows that ESPN puts on, we have Around the Horn, we have First Take, we have PTI, even the shows you could
ESPN say... ESPN 2 shows.
Well, PTI isn't. Around the Horn isn't.
Well, no, I'm saying like Levitard and Sports Nation.
Even the Numbers show and Sports Nation show, there's a high level of debate. I think that debate will be a part of SportsCenter. I'd like to see the idea of debates evolve into something a little bit more meaningful than volume over thoroughness and substance. I'd like to see that happen some.
Be careful, because the Poynter Institute is now listening to this podcast. Their alarm just went off as soon as you hit this topic. There's a big bat signal came out.
And the 15 candidates to be the successors to the Poynter Institute are taking note.
Listen, I've said it before, I'll say it again. The best ombudsman would be me. You'd never let me do it. I'd be the best ombudsman you ever had.
Well,
I push it into all kinds of crazy directions.
I'm having breakfast tomorrow with one of our former ombudsmen out here in L.A., Mr. Ohlmeyer.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that.
I would never want that job. That's a thankless job. But
For certain people that are built to do it, it's terrific. If you can pour your heart and soul into it, the hard part about it for us is that We spit out so much programming, 40,000 live hours a year of TV, how many millions of words in the internet, 26 magazines, 24/7 radio station, radio. I mean, we were reviewing we have a committee that we do for the selection of who the successor is, and I was going over.
I should have at least been on that committee.
Oh, well, you're on. We only had one meeting so far. So
thanks.
Consider yourself.
Can I call in like Charlie and Charlie's Angels?
Yeah. Anyway, I don't think anybody has done a column on ESPN Radio, and we must have had 80 somewhere close to 100 columns at this point.
Hmm.
But it's been an interesting enterprise.
Maybe because of the 8-second delay, anything that would have led to a column was excised somehow. All right, maybe it's not even possible to do that. You were talking about the debate thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a constant criticism of ESPN lately, that people are worried that the channel is now turning into just two people yelling at each other. And we've come and gone in waves with that. And now it seems like we're in a wave where debate has become
popular. What's really developed here is one show has hit a nerve because it's developed a debate personality.
Well, it's also hit ratings.
And that's part of the reason it's hit ratings. And the reason is these two personalities have clicked.
Stephen A. and Skip, you're
Stephen
talking
Stephen A. Smith and Skip Bayless early in the morning. First thing in the morning, and it has a natural content conceit of first take on things because everybody's out to have a take on something. The valuation of news in this day and age is considerable. So it's much more likely that people are looking to see, well, what does such and such think about this?
Yeah.
But I do think that there are places that debates can go that they haven't gone so far. So it'll be something that we should be looking at.
I agree with you. I'm glad we agree on that, John Walsh.
Yeah, well, you know, we get to agree on one thing every time I come on the podcast.
Debates can go in a lot of different directions. I think a good example of, in my opinion, the best way a debate can go is how Wilbon and Kornheiser do it, where they're arguing, but there's a healthy friendship that you feel the entire time. And when Levitard is on with either of them, I get the same feeling.
Yeah.
And even when I go on every once in a while, because I like those guys, and you know, there's not an antagonistic vibe to it. Skip and Stephen A. are actually friends with each other.
Yes.
And I even when they're antagonistic, I feel like it's almost like stage actors a little bit. Well, and that's the part I feel like the general public misses. Like they're doing a lot of this just to do it.
Yeah. Well, that's been a long tradition in TV. Howard Cosell was quite an actor in his day with debating the world of sports.
Yeah, but with him, you know this better than anyone. Late in his career, he became a real curmudgeon.
Yes.
And there was just, you know, he was using, if he had people on his show, he would really try to make them look bad.
I think he had trouble more with the sports and the way the sports were being run than he did with, you know, individuals.
And the jockocracy.
He did take after a couple of people. I think what's interesting with Mike and Tony, who have been doing this, and, you know, their friendship is what you see on the air. They'll talk the same way as they go to the parking lot, as you know.
And actually, it's 100% the same way, which is like, it's been the cliched way when people talk about them. Oh, they're like that out there. They really literally are. They're the same exact way.
Whether they're preparing for the show or they're going to dinner. But one of the things that gets lost in there, they will find a nuance when they're actually have agreement on a subject, and the nuance will make it sound like they're debating one another.
Right.
Or they'll pick... they'll agree on something, but it'll be one of their favorite subjects. So the other boy, either Mike or Tony will get to the other guy and say, "Your boy,"
right.
And that'll make it sound like there's a disagreement.
It's like a little derisive. Yeah. Yeah. They're really good at it. I watched that show really carefully, trying to figure out how I would be able to host if I hosted it. And there's so many subtle things that they do that just. It's so hard to step in on.
My God, they've done the darn thing for, I guess, 25, 26 years maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, just because I remember them in the Washington Post newsroom, or sports department, and they were doing it then.
Do you find it amusing, frustrating, annoying, or all three of those things, the way that ESPN is covered so voraciously by the sports critics and the blogosphere, just every single move. Like even like we had some free agents recently and it was covered like, you know, like LeBron James, you know, in this little sphere. Is too much made of that? Like, why do people care so much?
Well, it's interesting. I'll give you a little bit of history here from my perspective anyway. I always felt that the media paying attention to the metamedia stuff, didn't appeal to a general audience. Now, whenever I was in charge of something...
I agree with you, by the way.
When I started Inside Sports, I wanted to get the media's attention, the select media's attention, so we had a media column because I wanted people in the media to pay attention to us. I didn't care about the fans. That was written for media people, and like Ron Powers, who was the media critic for Inside Sports, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner, and he was on a very high level, so the people in the media had to pay attention to him.
Yep.
Now, I came to ESPN... There wasn't that much attention paid. But I think what happened with talk radio, where fans got involved with hosts, and now the internet, now the blogosphere, I am amazed at the number of the amount of attention that's paid to the media. We do a monthly chat, a transparency chat on ESPN.com, and a senior executive will go on there and answer questions for an hour. And we will get somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 to 150,000 people who will
pass through the chat.
Go through the chat. And that's a significant number of people. I mean, I told you when we did our first chat and we did it on the demise of the American newspapers, I walked out of here telling you, I don't know who the hell's going to listen to that. And then we looked around. I asked Patrick Stigman, who is the executive day-to-day fellow at ESPN.com, and said, Patrick, how many people? And it was over 120,000. It's crazy. There is an interest now. And there is an interest behind the scenes in the media. There's an interest of how things are done. There's also a lack of education about the seriousness with which decisions are made, the urgency or immediacy of making decisions. The way the media is developing, immediacy and urgency are more important than accuracy and thoroughness. And that's a fight that we constantly have about how we respond to the scrutiny and the criticism to try and be as transparent and try to get as much out there as we can when we know, when we have researched whatever happened behind the scenes to tell the story the way it really unfolded, instead of the way people, a lot of people guess about motivation. A lot of people guess about what we're trying to accomplish until they're there. And we have a significant number of people with journalistic bona fides who are making these decisions that they're making them out of some sense of what they think is right for whatever the issue is.
It's a weird time. I mean, it's a weird time to be on TV. It's a weird time to have a column. It's a weird time to do any of this stuff, because I think that the one thing that I'm surprised by is how quickly people are to the gotcha kind of mentality of.
Well, there are things that are unknown in people's lives, and there are things that you're just unaware of to make judgments about people. I think it's very hard to make judgments because you find things out. You know, there's people, or two people that I know, that I have a very good friend who is named Michael Sheehan, who is runs a speech consultant business in Washington, and he's also one of the poobahs that runs the speech impediment stutterers, National Stutter Society, and they have an award show every year, and
right.
You know, he's calling me up because Samuel L. Jackson had done three of the things. I had no idea Samuel L. Jackson had a stuttering problem as a child.
Really?
Yeah. And then they got a substitute host.
He would have been like in a fantasy draft. He would have been one of my last choices.
Well, here's the other thing is I worked alongside this guy. As a matter of fact, I helped hire him at ESPN. The substitute host was Josh Elliott.
And he also has speech?
Yeah.
Really?
I had no comprehension.
I mean, the
this.
Most famous one was Bill Walton, who couldn't say really anything when he was, you know, at UCLA. And if he got nervous, that was it. And now he became an announcer.
I'll tell you, it would be very interesting because of the number of the variety of guests you have. Michael would be, he's coming out for the ESPYs. I'll introduce you to him. He'd be an interesting guest to talk about the people and finding this out about them and in a position like that he has.
Yeah. Anything else we need to cover?
I think we've covered more than I imagined we'd cover at all. I think we've covered it up until, you know, the retirement podcast.
No, that's until 2014. When's your Grantland Network podcast going to start? There's been rumors.
That's up to you.
I already greenlit it. I'm the boss.
Okay, you're the boss, so let's just get the logistics going. I'm ready.
Do you know what it's going to be called?
I'll have to think of an inventive name. It won't be Grant. It won't be Rice.
Because you spend more time conceiving your fantasy team names than probably anybody ever. You have a theory of fantasy team names that the owner's name has to be in the name.
Well, or some characteristic about the owner, or some, you know, every fantasy team, the original fantasy league that was started, the Rotisserie League. It was the Okie Finokies were Dan Okrent. Everybody, the Glenn Wagoners were the Wagoners. Everybody connected their name. Rob Flater's team was the Flater Mice. Yeah. Everybody, so I remain true to that, and I try to do my best. And I think at ESPN, I'm partners with Marie Donahue. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm an albino and I look like Santa Claus. So our team name is the Donahoe Ho Ho's, and our other team name is the Santa Marie's.
Right.
So those are two of the more inventive names that we've come up with over the years. But I believe you have to make it a part of your personality. These people that call ourselves the David Sterns or people that, you know, that just invent something, I have no time for that.
So, like, the BS report is a name you'd approve because BS
yes,
is my initials.
Absolutely. And so matter of fact, ingenious.
All right. So we need to come up with something. Yeah. We wanted to have you every month or so. You talk to somebody who's interesting. Okay. We'll tape it and we'll put it on the Grantland Network.
I'm ready to go.
I think this could be a new career for you.
Well, I do enjoy our conversations.
All right.
On the air or off the air.
All right. Congrats on your 20th ESPYs.
Thank you.
All right,
bye-bye.
Talk to you soon.
Before I get the sound off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.